You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
A recent New York City pilot study of PCBs in schools found elevated levels of those polychlorinated biphenyls in the air at all the schools tested. And last month, several community groups hosted a scientific panel discussion to look into the problem. We have invited one of those scientists to our show today, Dr. Robert Herrick, senior lecturer in industrial hygiene at the Harvard School of Public Health, along with one of our favorite experts, industrial hygienist Monona Russell, to talk about what the new data might mean and what we can do about it. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Monona, can you tell us what the New York City study found?
Well, they studied three schools, and they found elevated levels at all of them, but two of them in really high levels. And they attributed it to the caulk in the windows and, you know, as a filling material, and to the ballasts in the old fluorescent lights. It's really kind of interesting that they found it now because we've known about this for decades. We know this is a problem.
Well, you say only three schools. It's a pilot study.
Right.
Are there plans to test all the schools? Or would you assume that the same would apply to every school in the system?
Well, they're really dragging their feet because Bloomberg said that it looks like it's going to cost around $1 billion to remove this material. And especially in the budget today, that really is a figure that we really can't handle. So they're trying to stall and say they're going to do more studies. That's one of the ways to stall things is to study it again. But it's a known problem.
Dr. Herrick, what exactly are PCBs and why do we use the plural?
Well, it's a family of chemicals. There's actually 209 individual chemicals that are known as PCB congeners. And those were the mixtures that were used extensively really going back to the 30s, as plasticizers to make rubber and coatings more flexible.
So they get used in a wide range of things. Monona mentioned caulking, but they can also be found in paints and plastics and insulation materials, roofing and siding materials, floor and ceiling tiles, adhesives, waterproofing compounds, fire retardant coatings. The list goes on and on and on. This is a ubiquitous group of chemicals.
Well, that's true. Over the years they were produced, there were about 1.4 billion pounds produced worldwide.
Like asbestos, does it depend on when a building was constructed as to how much PCB we'll find in it?
Yeah, it absolutely does. It turns out the period of peak use was the 50s through the late 70s. Which unfortunately corresponds to the period of peak school construction in the U.S.
Aren't they also found in household items and furniture, appliances, other household goods?
They do turn up in a lot of applications. At one point, one of the uses was the carbonless copy paper, you might remember, that was so common in offices.
And that's why we don't see them anymore, because laws have been passed to eliminate the use of PCBs?
Right. The EPA outlawed them effective 1978.
But we still have them all over the place.
Well, that's true. And in the case of these building materials, I think that's part of the problem is that some of this material is 40 or 50 years old, and these coatings and caulking materials are breaking down and releasing PCBs into the environment.
Now, Monona, Dr. Herrick said that they were banned by the EPA 40 plus years ago. Why were they banned? Why do we have to worry about PCBs?
Well, there was enough data for them to really ban them because they were causing cancer in animals. They cause all kinds of effects. In fact, lawyers of the public interest made a really good presentation at the meeting that I met Dr. Herrick on November 30th, where they talked about attention deficit disorders, that studies relate those. Childhood leukemia is related, diabetes. Asthma, leukemia, immune system problems. So it's pretty evident that these things cause serious problems.
Dr. Herrick, are all those things linked? Because we're talking about a wide-ranging list here. Endocrine, ADD.
Well, I think there are links there. As Winona pointed out, the concern was about the cancer-causing effects of PCBs, and that's been very well documented. But what's really, I think, becoming much more interesting and disturbing is the research that's emerging now about their potential as developmental toxins.
Winona, does it depend on whether the PCBs are inhaled, ingested, or absorbed through the skin?
Well, it may, but the real point is once it's in the body, it accumulates. It's a fat-soluble toxin, and it can remain in the body for very, very long periods of time.
And when someone comes down with one of those conditions, how can we know if exposure to PCBs was a cause?
There is no way, because remember, the Centers for Disease Control is studying some 200 chemicals that many people are carrying in their bloodstreams. PCBs are just one of those. You've got dioxins, you've got dibenzofurans, you've got DDT, DDE. We're really carrying a soup around. So it's impossible with all those variables to know which cancer is caused by what.
Robert, we mentioned that they've been found in schools. Are children more susceptible to the effects of PCBs than adults?
I think the evidence is emerging that that is, in fact, the case. The animal data that's been referred to, the limited human toxicity studies, clearly show that developing organisms are much more sensitive to these disruptive effects than adults.
My guests are Dr. Robert Herrick, Senior Lecturer in Industrial Hygiene at the Harvard School of Public Health, and our own, I almost ready to say, resident industrial hygienist on the show, Winona Russell. We are talking about PCBs, despite the fact that they are banned, they're all over the place. Can people be tested for exposure to PCBs, Robert?
Yes, they can. The technique that's used, unfortunately, requires a blood test. But that is a possibility, and in fact, there's a increasing interest among people in these buildings to have their blood tested.
Winona, do we know how long PCBs remain in our bodies? If I was exposed to PCBs when I went to school, which was a while back, would they still be there, or would they have been eliminated by now?
Yes, especially since there's so many of them, the lighter molecular weight ones may leave a little sooner than some of the others. But once they're in the fat, we don't tend to turn over our fat very fast. So their half-lives are in terms of many years. So you do slowly process some of them out of your body, but not at a very rapid rate.
When did public health officials first become aware of the hazards of these chemicals, Robert?
Well, the toxicity of the PCBs themselves has been documented really going back to the 40s. The interest and attention to this particular source that we're talking about now, the PCBs that people encounter from the caulking in buildings, really came to light in the early 90s in some studies that were done in Europe.
But they were banned in this country 32 years ago. So there were already concerns, although there was a big gap between the 40s and 1978.
Well, that's true. It just, you know, the accumulation of evidence, you know, finally reached a point where it was simply overwhelming. And EPA, when they promulgated the Toxic Substances Control Act, that was when they took the opportunity to ban them completely.
Winona, aren't PCBs classified as persistent organic pollutants? What does that mean?
Yes, they are. They're persistent in the environment, which means once they're there, they're sort of like there. And they're toxic, and they're bioaccumulative. So that means they can build up in systems like, you know, the predator-prey situation in the ocean and so on. They tend to stay in organisms.
We're talking about a whole class of chemicals, aren't we, Robert? You mentioned 209. No. Are some more dangerous than others?
Well, there are. There's some, and traditionally the concern has been among the chemicals that resemble dioxins because they're the ones that are most strongly suspected of causing cancer. But it is actually not unusual to find about 100 of these in environmental samples. And when it comes to the developmental toxicity, the evidence is emerging that it may in fact be the ones that don't look like dioxin that are actually the most potent.
So they were replaced after they were banned 32 years ago, replaced with polybrominated biphenyls. Are the PBBs any safer than the PCBs?
Well, just remember, if there's 209 congeners of PCBs, there are 209 congeners of PBBs. That's the polybrominated biphenyls. And then we stuck an oxygen in the middle of the two benzene rings in the structure, and now that is the polybrominated biphenyl ethers that everyone is talking about that is still leaking out of your computer. It's one of the fire retardants. And those are also implicated in the same kinds of problems. So we can remove the old paints with the PCBs, but, you know, how far up did we step? Now, the PBBs, we got out of the system pretty quickly. They were manufactured really only from 1970 to 1976. Why? Because we have really good human data on those. Some farmer was given some big sacks full of PBBs, and he thought it was a food additive for his cattle. And so we have a lot of human data from Michigan on people who ate the meat and drank the milk and
so on. What happened to them?
Well, they developed the same things that they saw in animals, like loss of hair and what we used to call chloracne, but we know it's also bromacne, and other types of illnesses in the short term. And we assume that some of these people will develop the long-term illnesses as well.
So, Robert, what are we using these days?
Well, there's a variety of substitute materials. Unfortunately, one of the things that tends to be used is phthalates, which, as we know, have their own set of issues surrounding them.
So there's nothing. So far, we've not come up with anything that is truly safe. We just some things that are less dangerous than others.
There are some formulations that don't really contain chemicals that have the sort of known toxicity that we're talking about at PCBs, and those are used in more modern applications.
So what are they putting in caulking these days?
Well, there's polyurethane systems. There's a variety of systems, because regardless of what you use, you know, in these masonry buildings, you really do need something to seal the joints around the windows and so forth.
Yeah, in fact, the people that I deal with, the artists who use caulking materials, I have a short data sheet on the various types of the clear caulk, the white caulk, the black caulk, and some of the different manufacturers. And some of them are much safer than others. So there are things that we should be doing in that, but it's not a simple answer.
We'll take a little break, and we'll come back with more with my guests, Manona Russell and Dr. Robert Herrick. We're talking about PCBs. It turns out that even though they were banned in 1978, there's an awful lot of them still floating around in our schools, and we'll find out just how much in our homes after we take this break. Inspired by a recent New York City pilot study of PCBs in schools, we're looking into just how ubiquitous PCBs are, not only in our schools, but in our homes, with Dr. Robert Herrick, senior lecturer in industrial hygiene at the Harvard School of Public Health, and with Manona Russell, whose organization is Arts, Crafts, and Theater Safety, Incorporated. So what about our schools? Are individual homes involved as well? Should homeowners be testing for PCBs?
Yes, because When I was starting in this field, I was reading something called the Journal of Coatings Technology. It really is the industry talking it to itself. And the PCBs were marketed to manufacturers of paints and caulks for home products also as the miracle material. They were fire retardants, plasticizers. They kept the stuff from yellowing. They were like forever. And so,
and they seemed great.
Oh, they seemed marvelous at the time because they are what is called inert in the sense that they don't break down quickly and volatilize in the same way and speed as, for instance, a solvent would. So they were really used in everything. In fact, the EPA estimated in an article that they put in the Federal Register in 1991 that somewhere between 10% and 30% concentrations of PCBs were in some of those early polymer paints.
Well, Robert, we're concerned about babies biting painted wall, you know, the various things that have been painted with lead paint, should we be just as concerned about whether PCBs were in the paint, even if there was no lead?
Well, I think that is a real concern.
Or toys?
Actually, I'm sorry?
Or toys, for that matter?
Or toys, yeah. Of the different things to concern about, I would be more interested in the soil around the buildings, frankly, because the data shows very clearly that the PCBs are being released from these paints and caulking materials and causing soil contamination around the perimeter of buildings, including these schools. And as we know with kids, you know, if it's in the dirt, it's on the hands, and if it's on the hands, it's in the mouth. So that's definitely a source of exposure.
How do we test for these things? Do we take samples of all the different materials used in a building and send them to a lab? And are there companies that specialize in this type of testing, Monona?
Yeah, I was looking on the internet, and there's a number of companies that will do this kind of testing. And, of course, you can look up the people who were doing the testing for the study of the schools. And they test them in a number of ways. They test what is in the air, because some of them are slowly volatilizing and getting in the air. And EPA has a standard for how much is too much. You can test the dust by doing what's called wipe samples, where you make a template and then you wipe the area with a distilled water filter paper and then test that. You can test the soil, which is called a bulk sample. So we can do these kinds of tests if we wish.
And I'm assuming that somebody who's contemplating buying an older home should consider this kind of test.
Yes, I would. And if the money is really tight, one thing you can do is simply remove a lot of this stuff whole. I mean, if you take out a whole door and get rid of it, you don't have to worry about how much there is, because you're not, if you scrape that door, if you refinish it, now you may be exposed to it because you're going to create dust and so on.
But what about other things, Robert? If PCBs are found to be present, what can we do?
Well, I think that's really the issue that EPA needs to address through its research, because if the data holds up when we look for these materials, especially in public buildings, we'll probably find it in about a third of the buildings that were constructed during the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And then the people who own the building or run the schools are faced with that very question, you know, what guidance is available to help them make the right decisions and decide what to do. And unfortunately, at the moment, what they seem to be forced with is the prospect of removing the PCBs, which can be extremely expensive.
We have Linda Rosenthal, an assembly member who's active in PCB issues, on the line. Hi, Linda.
Hey. Hello.
I'm sure you've been listening to this conversation with interest.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
So what is the government doing about all of this? We haven't seen too much coming out of Congress. The last time we have talked about the proposed Toxic Chemical Safety Act that was sponsored by Senator Lautenberg in the Senate and Representatives Rush and Waxman in the House, but they didn't pass, did they?
No, they died in committee, as the ones have done previously.
Yeah, I mean, there's disbelief in numerous quarters about the dangers of PCBs. The issue that I'm grappling with in my district is in that there's a school, an elementary school, PS199, which has demonstrated levels of PCBs. And I have introduced a bill in the past session in Albany, and I will be introducing another bill come January regarding PCBs in light ballasts. The EPA and the Department of Education in the city are doing a pilot project where they are testing for PCBs in certain schools in different boroughs. And in several of the schools, they have found high levels of PCBs that are coming from the light ballast, some of which have been in place since the 50s. The EPA and DOE agreed that they would remove in those schools all of the light fixtures and replace them with new ones. And in those schools, the levels of PCBs dropped dramatically. And so it seems logical to then proceed to the other schools that were built within the window where PCBs were used, 1950 to 1978, and remove those light fixtures to eliminate any kind of danger to the children and the staff, the teachers, everyone who works and stays in that building. The Department of Education has proven to be a vigorous opponent of this approach. Now, this is not the Bush EPA. This is a brand new EPA. And Judith Ink, who is the head of Region 2, has been a vigorous fighter for this solution. And she and the DOE, Dennis Walcott, the deputy mayor for education, who you'd think would be interested in protecting the health and safety of children, is fighting with the EPA and saying, you know what, it's really not a big danger, and we can't afford it, and so, you know, let's just wait and see what this pilot study brings.
Well, and the pilot study included the school you're talking about, PS199,
yes,
didn't it?
But yes.
But as we mentioned earlier, mm-hmm, it's projected that it's going to cost $1 billion to clean up the contaminated schools, and I can't imagine too many people in government right now, mm-hmm, being all that excited about spending $1 billion on something when
we're in one city.
Well, you know what?
In New York City alone, when they don't even want to help the people who were hurt in the cleanup after 9/11.
I know, but Regional Administrator Inc. has written a letter to Mr. Walcott, which I'm going to quote for you. It said, in your letter, you estimated it would cost $1 billion to replace all the older fluorescent lighting fixtures in city school buildings. We have no understanding of how this figure was arrived at. So she is disputing that it would cost so much. She's also saying that the city should take advantage of current federal programs such as qualified school construction and zone academy bonds. And she has been working assiduously on finding public-private partnerships to get this done. This would also, first of all, it would eliminate PCB contamination from a known source. Secondly, it would convert to green energy, which will ultimately pay for itself within 3 to 5 years in savings. It would create jobs. But most importantly, this is a program that can be done if the city puts its head together, or its various heads, together with the EPA and looks to come up with funding. Instead, the DOE has said, we're not interested. And that is criminal.
Now, I want to bring Robert Herrick into this conversation. Is this something that is unique to New York, or are we going to be hearing about this from all over the country?
No, I don't think it's unique to New York at all. In fact, there's been extensive activity in Massachusetts and Connecticut and Rhode Island. And I'm quite sure when there's a national survey done, this sort of issue is going to, you know, turn up virtually every place where we look for it.
Linda, thank you so much for calling in and filling us in on your side of the problem.
Yes.
Dealing with this. There are some other government issues. A listener wonders about the PCBs in the Hudson River. Have they been cleaned up?
Oh, that's a continuing battle, and it just never seems to end because they have been resisting doing what they are supposed to, and they're only going to cap, I think it's 11% of the total projected area is what GE has finally agreed to.
11%?
Yeah.
That's 89% will be
left
untouched.
Will still be there, left there for the...
And what does that mean? That means, of course, that we can't eat any fish that are caught in the Hudson River because they'll be contaminated with PCBs?
Yeah, that's been a problem for a long, long time. And when they remove them for a short while, it'll be even worse because, of course, they'll be stirring up all of that sediment. If they could just get it all out, then we would, in a few years, it would clear up and we might be able to go back to eating fish from the Hudson.
I'm talking to two industrial hygienists, Manona Russell and Dr. Robert Herrick. He's a senior lecturer in industrial hygiene at the Harvard School of Public Health. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Listeners have been writing in. Opal left a comment on our show page. She wonders if there are PCBs in the rope caulking that she uses to winterize her windows.
Well, if she bought it now, no.
Mm-hmm.
But there could very well be the PB, the polybrominated biphenyl ethers. There could be phthalates. There could be a number of chemicals there
that would still be of concern.
Yes, and we still don't know much about them, but we suspect we're going to have the same problems.
Robert, is this a priority for industry, finding safe alternatives for these chemicals?
Well, the entire remediation and building renovation industry is really taking off, especially in New England and New York, where there's been some regulatory pressure brought to bear. And the other point I would make is that when it comes to these PCB clocks, as I said earlier, these things in some cases are 40 or 50 years old. They're deteriorated, they're cracking, they're literally falling from the buildings. And so there's a huge industry that's very active in replacing this material right now.
In removal in the same way that there are asbestos removers. What about another approach, covering them up, sealing them? Is that possible?
That really is a possibility. If there can be, for instance, wall boards, and, you know, keeping the paints and the caulks at a distance, covering them over with various things, just as we keep asbestos in place in certain situations, that can be certainly a temporary fix.
What about when old buildings are being demolished or renovated?
There's no rules.
There are no rules?
they have
so
rules.
So I'm walking down the street and there's all this
lead.
Dust coming out?
Yeah, but that's why, especially because I also deal with scenic artists and people who are constantly working in abandoned buildings and tearing up stuff, that, you know, it isn't just the lead you have to worry about. There's other things in those old paints.
Robert, do you have any advice for people who are doing work on their homes and apartments? How can they avoid breathing in the dust or otherwise being exposed to these chemicals?
Well, I think the principle that we could invoke is the same that we do when we're concerned about lead or asbestos contamination. And really step one before a renovation project is initiated would be to test the material and see if, you know, any of these contaminants are present in the first place. And if they are, in fact, you know, it's probably wise to have a licensed contractor involved and do the work properly.
Now, it was mentioned earlier that there are people who really are skeptical about all of this. What are their arguments?
Well, this is the real...
I mean, other than they don't want to spend the money.
Yeah, this is the real crux of everything, and that is there is very little data when you really look at it on a lot of chemicals. And that's what we've talked about before. The European Union has finally recognized this and said, industry has to test. We have to know. The fact that we don't know is industry's fault. They should be testing these things before they put them in our caulks and our ballasts and our paints and the other products. But they never did, and they still don't today. The general process is you invent a chemical, you find a market for it. And we need to break that idea and make sure there's a testing area in there. And the European Union is forcing testing of a lot of chemicals. The fact that we don't have all this data, we have to use what's called the precautionary principle. If we know that the five or six or seven congeners we know a great deal about cause certain diseases, we can assume they probably all do.
Is the EU requiring testing for PCBs?
No, but they're requiring testing of the brominated compounds, and they banned a number of them already.
Robert Herrick, what are people saying in academia?
Well, I think the interest is peaking. You know, people have been studying PCBs for a very long time, but as we mentioned, it was primarily around the cancer risk. But the data that's emerging now about the developmental toxicity, when you start seeing, you know, very well-conducted studies that show that kids who have the higher PCB exposures have lower IQ. There's suggestions of link to behavioral disorders, all kinds of developmental problems. That's the kind of thing that gets the attention of the research community. And you know, it's barely a week that goes by now that there isn't some sort of a article published that reveals more information about this aspect of PCB toxicity.
Are there books or websites or other places where listeners can get more information about this?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Manona first, and then
Well,
Robert.
What I did just to prepare for the program is just do a little Googling, and it was amazing the number of papers that come up when you start looking for PCBs.
But you can't trust
effects.
Everything that you find on the
well,
net.
Well, that's the key. You know, if they're selling something on the site, it's the wrong site. So you do want to go to the major universities. You really want to go to governmental sites because, surprisingly, government doesn't have as many access to grind as industry does. If it says it's the phthalate panel or the PCB group, you know, you don't read that. But if you're savvy and look at who's paying for the study, follow the money, you can find some really good things on the Internet.
Has Harvard put anything up on the internet?
Well, there's links to the articles that we've published that I've written, as well as my colleagues have. But I would say, in answer to your question about a good place, sort of a one-stop shopping for PCB information, I would go to PCBinschools.org. It's put together by a concerned parent who updates it constantly, and he has links on there to information in the scientific literature and also things that are in the popular media.
I saw that. It was very well done.
I assume, Monona, that as usual, you will be responding to some of the things that people put on our comment page.
I answer some way or other every email that comes in. And so it takes me about a day, but I know I'm going to be dedicating my time to it. So be patient, and it'll be up on your site, on the site.
I want to thank both of you so much for being with us, Monona Russell of Arts, Crafts, and Theater Safety, Inc., and Dr. Robert Herrick, Senior Lecturer in Industrial Hygiene at the Harvard School of Public Health. It's been fascinating.
It was lovely.
Eye-opening and scary.